Studio 360.
This next one's a bit PG, so parents of young kids, consider yourself warned. Back in the 1960s, as the sexual revolution ramped up, a lot of Americans also started going for more frank depictions of sex, especially in fiction, in novels. The legal ban on sexually explicit books, like Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, ended in 1964. Soon, other A-list literary writers like John Updike were going there. But even more, publishers of very commercial fiction cranked up the new smut machine and churned out trashy sexual romps that became huge bestsellers, such as Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne.
She felt herself responding to his embrace with an ardor she had never dreamed she possessed, her mouth demanding more and more.
And The Adventurers by Harold Robbins.
Her mouth was warm and moist and still tasted of orange soda. And his lips were traveling down her body, over her breasts.
Which was great if you were 11 or 12 and finding these paperbacks on your parents' bedside tables. But the literary mandarins were appalled. In 1966, Lewis Nichols, writing in the New York Times about that year's bestsellers, said that, quote, "Seldom has there been so wretched a collection of titles as appears today." But the greatest example of wretched erotica, truly laughably bad, came along a couple of years later. And how it came along is itself like a comic novel. Studio 360's Sam Kim has the story.
It all started in 1966 in this bar in Garden City, Long Island called The Sulky.
Which was a place where you could listen to music, have a drink, dance.
That's Marilyn Berger. She was the diplomatic correspondent at Newsday, the daily newspaper of Long Island. Back then, many of her coworkers would retire each night to The Sulky, including a 33-year-old columnist named Mike McGrady.
Gin mills that year were filled with writers anesthetizing themselves against the harsh new realities of their profession.
McGrady died in 2012. In 1970, he wrote a memoir about this period, read here by actor Greg Tannen.
To be a serious writer in the year 1966 was also to be a serious drinker.
They had a piano bar, you know, and there were some attractive women who hung out there.
That's Harvey Aronson. He was a columnist at Newsday.
I remember once I drank champagne out of a secretary's shoe and told everybody that I was getting athlete's foot of the mouth.
And they'd be up drinking in this place.
George Vesey was Newsday's sports reporter.
And then people would talk, and all the hair was let down, and
they were discussing the status of American literature.
That's Tony Insolia. He was the editor for Newsday for over 30 years. Stanley Green was the day news editor.
Mike used to complain about books like Harold Robbins and Jackie Suzanne.
I was appalled by the kind of books making enormous successes. Look at the garbage that gets printed.
That's when the idea hit him. McGrady thought, Suzanne's and Robbins' books were schlock, but they were selling millions of copies. So what if you actually tried to write a preposterously bad erotic novel? Would it be just as successful?
Everyone at Newsday could do one chapter. We would each write about one specific perversion, and we put them all together. We could write the whole thing in a week.
And what came out of it was a plan for writing the worst bestseller in the world.
He said, we'll make a lot of money. I said, we're not going to make any money, but I thought we'd have a lot of fun.
So McGrady got home from the bar that night, poured himself a nightcap, and typed a memo to his coworkers.
You are hereby officially invited to become the co-author of a best-selling novel. There will be an unremitting emphasis on sex. Also, true excellence in writing will be quickly blue-penciled into oblivion.
He then typed out a plot outline that would connect all the disparate sex scenes.
Each chapter will involve Miss Jillian Blake, homewrecker. As the book opens, she learns that her husband William has been conducting an affair. She is unfaithful at first to even the score. She is unfaithful for a while because she enjoys it. She is unfaithful finally because she makes it a goal to destroy the seemingly happy marriages that surround her.
The next day, McGrady circulated the memo in the Newsday office.
I came in late at night, and I found a note in my mailbox.
George Vesey took the memo home. He decided to write his chapter while he was supposed to be doing yard work.
So, yeah, mowers would have been on my mind. And I typed it out in half an hour.
Morton Earbrow found himself staring hard at her slim, exciting face, then staring hard at her slim, exciting body. Her arms were slim and exciting, too. "The mower is in the garage," she said. She had removed the belt to his Bermuda shorts, and then, without words, they merged. In the dark, in the cool darkness, they communicated.
I remember using the word communicated a lot, which is kind of a stupid word for making love, but that's what I was up to.
Faster and faster they communicated, harder and harder. Fingers and nails on skin, teeth on skin, then great shudders of total communication. They came apart and rested in the dark. He said, "I'd forgotten there was more to life than mowing the lawn."
3 weeks later, a total of 24 Newsday writers, 20 men and 4 women, sent in a chapter. A few of the submissions were poetic, sophisticated, intelligent. In other words, unacceptable.
Some of the chapters were much too good, and I had to work like hell to make them bad enough to use.
You know, it's not easy to write bad.
McGrady enlisted one of the writers, Harvey Aronson, to share editing duties.
To really write bad is hard, and some of it was just moderately stupid.
Together, they downgraded the prose, combined some of the chapters, cut a few submissions, and one chapter that got the axe was Marilyn Berger's.
I didn't make the cut. And my sister said, "Well, it was obviously too well written." And my mother said, "It wasn't sexy enough." I think that may be the first time I heard my mother say sexy.
A couple days before I talked to Marilyn, I went to the archives at Columbia University. That's where Mike McGrady donated many of the documents from his career. I made copies of some of the unused chapters from the book. Do you still have your chapter, by the way?
No, I was going to ask you if you had it.
You know what? I have some of it. And
can I see it?
So I handed her a copy. And for the first time in over 50 years, she read her submission that was cut from the manuscript.
She pressed her body against his, kissing first his fingers, then his arm, his chest, his mouth. They orchestrated a rhythm that he had once said was composed of everything they both had ever known, of surf and swaying trees, of crowded traffic and musty rooms, of sweet flowers and moonlight, of life itself.
Okay. What did you think when you read that?
I'm amazed.
Yeah.
I was pretty... No, I wasn't so naive then. I was just sort of younger. I don't remember a word of it. And I am so happy you've come up with a copy.
Meanwhile, for the submissions that did make the cut, Mike and Harvey were working to cobble them together to make them seem like they were all written by one person. So Mike invented a collective pseudonym for all the writers, Penelope Ash. Penelope Ash, as he described to his co-conspirators, was a demure Long Island housewife. And for the title, the Newsday writers scanned through a list of bestsellers and found that the words stranger and naked were frequently used. So they combined the two together to create the title for their opus. Naked came the stranger. There were 14 chapters in the manuscript. One was by a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Robert Greene.
She stepped out of the dress. She was wearing no bra. Pink-white peaks rising from the residue of her tan.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jean Golds.
And they reached for each other and found pleasure in gentle caresses. Then faster, quicker, faster, needful. Willoughby was lost in immense billowy softness and riotous colors and roaring winds. He was the sand and the sea and the star-pierced sky.
When I asked the writers to name their favorite chapter in the book, it was unanimous.
I think that John Cummings' chapter is the funniest.
John Cummings, who died in 2016, was an investigative reporter at Newsday.
He claimed that when he was a young man in the Marines. He had an adventure with a woman in the Philippines who was a hooker, and that at the climactic moment of their involvement, pressed an ice cube up his rear end. And he wrote this line, which is in the book. You can find it exactly.
And then Ernie felt it. She shoved the ice in, the big rock candy mountain. Together, like garden snakes, they contorted, moaned, gasped, clenched, and throbbed. Ernie found what Cervantes and Milton had only sought. He thought the fillings in his teeth would melt.
The imagery was absurd. The perversions were plentiful. It was then that I began to sense that it was going to work. It was actually going to work.
It's true. They did succeed in the first part of their plan. They wrote a genuinely terrible novel. But what self-respecting book publisher would actually publish this?
I'm a book publisher and proud of it. Yeah, I influenced an entire generation.
That's Lyle Stewart speaking in 2005. In the late 60s, he was known for publishing controversial, sexually explicit books like The Art of Erotic Seduction. Mike had previously written about him for a Newsday article.
He broached the idea to Lyle Stewart. When Mike told him it was going to be put on, he thought that was great. So we needed somebody to front for the book.
There was the name, Penelope Ash. We needed a woman who might fit the name.
They decided on Mike's sister-in-law, a 38-year-old writer named Billy Young. After weeks of trying to track her down...
Hello?
Hi, Billy.
How are you?
She agreed to talk on the phone.
Well, actually, Mike had talked to me about it for a while, and I thought it was one of the most beautiful plans I'd ever heard, because I was always impressed with what Orson Welles had done with War of the Worlds, and this was just as good a spoof in my mind.
So she went to Lyle Stewart, and he loved her. He thought she'd be great as a front for the book. So that was it, and he said he would publish it.
So 3 years after it was just an offhand comment at the sulky bar, the book was finally published. For the cover, Lyle Stewart used this stock photo of a kneeling naked woman. And for the author photo, they used a picture of Billy Young. The plan was for Billy to appear on television and radio, posing as Penelope Ash. But before she did, Mike and Harvey prepped her for the interviews.
So we went to Billy's home, and she said, you know, what should she do? What can she say? And I remember saying to her, tell them that virginity is like a Tiffany lamp. And she said, what does that mean? And I said, I don't have the faintest idea, but it sounds great.
I went into Neiman Marcus, and I bought a couple of very sexy outfits and suits. It was, you know, a little more flamboyant than I would personally wear. But it was for a role, and that's what I wore to the interviews.
Penelope Ash, the author.
I think this is what the public is buying today, sex.
A couple months later, I'm on my patio. I hear her being interviewed on a radio show. Oh, well, you know, virginity is like a Tiffany lamp. I just laid on the ground on the stone patio and just beat my hand on the ground.
I knew I could carry it off, but when it came to fruition, the only emotion that I could tell you that I felt, scared. And it was frightening that the whole world knew me now. In those years, I was pretty shy, and that was what cured me. You take the shyest person and you do that a couple of times, and the shyness can be cured. I'm a living example.
Across the country, the book sold between 20 and 30,000 copies so far, and they're still going in some areas like hotcakes.
The New York Times printed a one-paragraph dismissive review, unaware that it was a spoof.
It would be nice if this book could be judged by its cover, which is easily the best part. In the category of erotic fantasy, this one rates about a C.
So the hoax seemed to be fooling everyone, and McGrady and the other writers were in no hurry to disabuse the notion that Penelope Ash and the book were real. But then...
somebody tipped off a reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
And so they were asked, please keep it secret, because we wanted to see how high it would go.
Robert Mayer was a columnist at Newsday. He co-wrote one of the chapters.
The Wall Street Journal was adamant they said they weren't going to hold it. They knew enough about it to go with the story.
And right after that, all over the world. I mean, it was insane. Newspapers all across the United States jumped on it. It just went wild.
Back in 1966, here at the offices of Newsday, 25 young writers got together and perpetrated a gigantic hoax.
Naked Came the Stranger was supposed to have been written by a first-time authoress trying her best. Instead, it turns out it was written by a bunch of other people trying to do their worst.
I was sent off to Paris to cover the Vietnam peace talks. And I opened up the International Herald Tribune while I was waiting for the press conference to begin. And there it was. Naked Came the Stranger, the spoof of the century.
Walter Cronkite sent a helicopter that landed on a lawn across the street from Newsday's office. And Mike and I and a friend named Lou Schwartz were in the I don't know how Lou got in there, but he was in the helicopter with us, and they flew us to New York.
A new novel about sex in suburbia was published this week. It seems to be on the way to becoming another instant bestseller. But it is not all it seems to be. It says Jacqueline Suzanne move over, you got to move way over to make room for 24 men. And that's the way it is, Wednesday, August 6, 1969.
And I remember looking down at New York City, and Lou Schwartz said, "It's all yours. The city is all yours."
And on September 1969, the real Penelope Ash made her first national televised appearance on The David Frost Show.
Will you now meet the authoress of Naked Came the Stranger, Penelope Ash?
They parted the drapes, and one after another, I think about 19 of us were there. We walked through as the author, Penelope Ash. That was a fun night.
We got a lot of applause, and Billy came in wandering around the stage with her Russian wolfhound.
Why did I bring the dog? I don't have an idea. Maybe I took her because I was too scared.
David Frost told us afterwards that he was scared shitless that the wolfhound was going to have an accident during the program.
A month later, the book had sold over 90,000 copies. It gradually crept up the New York Times bestseller list, reaching number 3, just behind The Love Machine by none other than Jacqueline Suzanne. In other words, the book that was parodying Suzanne was now rivaling her in sales. Mike and Harvey soon got a call. It was Bernard Geis, the man who published Suzanne's Valley of the Dolls.
He called us to his office. He said, "You guys write a sequel. You're going to make $1 million. And Mike and I looked at each other, and we both said, no. We did it once. I wasn't going to do it again.
Harvey left Newsday to write for New York Magazine. He's proud of his role in Naked Came the Stranger, but not without reservations.
I hope that when I go to the great beyond, that is not the defining clause in the first paragraph. I mean, it can be in the obit, but I don't want it in the first paragraph.
Robert Mayer was just as conflicted. After all, the hoax had proved that the standards of readers were even lower than what Mike had cynically predicted.
I didn't know whether I should laugh. I'll cry. To laugh that we had pulled off, that this hoax had worked great, but also to cry at the taste of America that we had exposed.
It was a feeling we all shared from time to time.
This was how Mike McGrady ended his 1970 memoir.
The fun seemed to vanish. Even with the first wild thought that the stunt might work, there was the fear that, yes, the stunt just might work. Later, as it all came to pass, there were always counter-emotions, unexpected misgivings that took the edge off elation. It was too easy. It all went too smoothly. America. You sit there, you plump beauty, still buying neckties from sidewalk Sharpies, still guessing which walnut shell contains the pea, still praying along with Elmer Gantry. America, sometimes I worry about you.
From this merry-go-round.
That story was produced by Studio 360's Sam Kim. Since we first aired it in 2017, Stan Green and Robert Mayer have died. Greg Tannen read from Mike McGrady's memoir, Stranger Than Naked, and Lorraine Mattox read the excerpts from Naked Came the Stranger.
He thought the fillings in his teeth would melt. Whew. It's hot in here.